You're listening to Truth Quest with Melody on KHENLPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community-supported radio. We're streamed on the internet at khen.org. And if you would like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest with Melody, they're available at www.gimmesometruth.info or linked from the khen.org website. And I'm Melody, and my co-host this evening is Dr. Eric Carlstrom, a professor of geography at California State University, Stanislaus, with nearly 30 years teaching experience. And our special guest this evening is Vicki Davis. She's back with us again, and I will go ahead and let Eric and Vicki go with our subject this evening. So you want to go for it?
Thank you, and welcome, Vicki. It's nice to be able to talk to you again. It's been about a year, I think, since we've had a chance to talk. And just to begin, could you briefly tell us, before I launch into our first question, could you tell us a little bit about your website and your expertise?
Mm-hmm. My website is www.channelingreality.com. And I was a computer systems analyst for about 20 years, working on primarily mainframe computer systems for corporations and government, working on large systems. And after 2000, you know, when I couldn't find contracts anymore, I started investigating, trying to figure out what was going on in our country that... Well, I didn't know, you know, initially I was just on the Internet because I had a lot of time on my hands, and then I discovered a lot of things, and it kind of set me on this odyssey of trying to get to the bottom of what really is going on in this country that is transforming life from the America that I knew and grew up in to something entirely different and unrecognizable.
We've talked two times before with you, and your interviews can be found on Melody's archive, which is www.givemesometruth.info, and all her and our interviews are archived there, and the two that we've done, I think, with you, Vicki, have been extremely informative. Before we jump into my first question, though, I just wanted to read... this is from a book called Stranger Than Fiction, An Independent Investigation of the True Culprits Behind 911 by a guy named Albert D. Pastore, Ph.D., and I believe that's a pseudonym. And he says that he researched 911 for a year, and he said this research can literally be described as, quote, above-cover intelligence work. Many of the world's top intelligence services are actually known to dedicate time and resources to scrutinizing what they refer as, quote, the open media in this manner. With some common sense and a few mouse clicks, Google or Yahoo search engines on the Internet now enable anyone with an ounce of curiosity to become a Sherlock Holmes. And you have more than an ounce of curiosity, and you have a great deal of skill, and I think you've been able to use the information on the Internet to pull together the big picture. And this is on your website, again, www.channelingreality.com, which I would recommend to our listeners. Now, let me just see if I can zero in on one of the many things that you have written. This is an article called Full Throttle Reverse Engineering Civilization, which I think you wrote a couple of years ago, maybe a year ago. And before... I'm sorry, this is so long-winded, but Melody and I have interviewed Dr. Tim Ball, Canada's first climatology PhD, several times now. Those are also on her website. We have pretty well established, I think, that the global warming, the man-caused global warming myth is a fraud, and yet it's perpetuated daily in the media. It advances a science a political agenda which has nothing to do with science. There's a book called Heaven and Earth: Global Warming, the Missing Science by Ian Plimmer. It's School of Earth and Environmental Sciences at the University of Adelaide, which really does a beautiful job for a 500-page book of refuting this whole man-caused global warming thing. And this is from a professional who has studied this stuff. And in his last chapter, chapter 8, he says, "We are facing the greatest global threat in my 72 years. Okay. I was reading the last chapter of a book called Heaven and Earth, Global Warming, The Missing Science by Professor Ian Plimmer of the School of Earth and Environmental Sciences, University of Adelaide in Australia. And his chapter starts, "We are facing the greatest global threat in my 72 years. It is not global warming. It is the threat from policy responses to perceived global warming and the demonizing of dissent. These policies also threaten freedoms and the nature of science and religion. Policy changes have the ability to reduce baseload energy supplies of electricity that underpin employment and the standard of living. There are calls for trials and imprisonment of those scientists who, on scientific evidence, do not agree that human emissions have caused climate. Such scientists are called deniers and are compared to Holocaust deniers, yet their scientific doubts are not addressed. Some environmental advocates of human-induced global warming are promoting Nuremberg-type trials for those who dissent. Those who have enjoyed the stifling benefits of totalitarian communism systems see the green movements in democratic countries as destroying hard-earned freedom." Okay, so I'm going to stop there, Vicki. And so my question, as we've studied this issue in some of my classes, it's pretty easy to demonstrate that the amount of warming we've seen in the 20th century is really quite small relative to past natural cycles, and that CO2 is not a major driver of climate change. Rather, in fact, that it responds to temperature changes. It does not drive them. And yet, we are hearing daily from the BBC and other media that, the situation is worse than we thought, and getting all these terrible projections. So what would you say are the underlying reasons for this global warming fraud that is being perpetuated upon us?
It's purely political, and it goes back to even before Lyndon Johnson and the Great Society. It goes back, there was a group called the Technocracy that Patrick Wood of the August Review recently rediscovered. And the ideas of the Technocracy were that currency should be based upon a formula for the amount of energy it took to produce whatever it was that you're talking about. And so they tried to work out a calculation for that so that energy would be the basis of currencies. And if you follow the history, from that point forward, you can trace where this global warming is actually a political agenda by a group of people, technocrats, that operate at a global level. And in order to implement this global agenda, global control of resources, global control of everything, to solve what they consider to be common global problems, they had to find some kind of a unifying, universal reason for it, and so they came up with global climate change. And okay. And the terror of we're all going to die if we don't, if we don't do what they say, we're all going to die, basically.
Well, in fact, we can trace the thinking back to some of the elite institutions. The Club of Rome, for instance, which I think is closely allied with the UN, wrote in 1973 in one of their books, in searching for a new enemy to unite us, we came up with the idea that pollution, the threat of global warming, water shortages, famine, and the like would fit the bill. So they're trying to find a new enemy, a common enemy that would organize our spending in society. And they're mentioning, in fact, global warming and the environmental issues as this new common enemy.
Yes. Well, and that's part of my research that I just recently completed. It's called the stalking horse on my website. And I was tracing the history of Club of Rome, you know, who the guys were that started it. And it turns out that it was actually started at the behest of our very own government. Dean Rusk heard a speech done by Peachy. I'm probably massacring his name, but Aurelio Peachy.
Peachy, P-E-C-C-I?
Yeah, Peachy, is that how you say it?
That's how I would say it. You might be right, though.
Well, I'm not sure about that, but anyway, he heard this guy give a speech down in South America, and he came back, and basically they all got together, and McGeorge Bundy was enlisted by Johnson to get Peachy to help set up an organization called the International Institute of Applied Systems Analysis. And then Peachy went on with Alexander King to start the Club of Rome. So the way what it looks like to me is that the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis is the working international think tank to analyze, design, and solve alleged global problems, and the Club of Rome is the public face of it, because of course they, you know, they're kind of like a facade group, okay? This institute was originally conceived in 1966, authorized by Lyndon Johnson, and it was chartered in 1972, and it was both the United States and the Soviet Union. And scientists from both the Soviet Union and the United States had been working together to solve alleged common problems since 1972.
Here's my tentative list of underpinning reasons for the global warming fraud. Number one, it advances the cause of world government, as Tony Blair or Gordon Brown recently has said, and many of others have said, global problems require global solutions. It is, number two, the moral equivalent of war, as the Club of Rome documents show, and as the report from Iron Mountain documents show also, because you have to have some kind of external enemy to organize your society and to destroy excess capital, like 10 or 20% of gross national product, so that the poor don't get too rich. Number three, it advances an agenda for depopulation. Number four, it advances an agenda for deindustrialization. And number five, and this is what comes out in your report, Full Throttle Reverse Engineering Civilization, the carbon credits then would be used as the underlying value of the world financial system rather than the dollar. And this then becomes a market commodity that can be traded. And as such, then the very few at the top can do, in fact, a controlled demolition of industrial society. Would you agree with that? Number one, and number two, if you do agree, could you expand on that a little bit?
Yes, and that's exactly the way that I see it. As a matter of fact, I was looking at the International Monetary Fund website just this morning for something else that I was writing, and I found a fact sheet on the special drawing rights, which I believe are going to be basically the carbon credits. And they kind of have to be, because what they are, they're just basically a coupon. They're made out of the currencies, out of a basket of currencies that I guess they average or something to come up with the value. And since and the value of it is based on the export, the amount of exports that a country has. Okay, the problem with that is they're basing it on the U.S. currency, the U.K., Japan, and one other one, I forget which one. But anyway, both the U.S. and the U.K. are number one and number two in trade deficits. So by definition, if you're using our currency, our export values, as a basis for the special drawing rights, you're going to come up with a negative number, which is a credit. And if you are, what the World Bank policy is going to be is that if you implement sustainable development, the policies that they're handing down, which is the technocratic tyranny, they will give you the money for doing it. You know, it's kind of a Orwellian kind of strategy. You know, reduce poverty, reduce carbon emissions, and we'll give you credits for doing that. Okay? So, but in like the third world countries, that means, you know, to eliminate poverty, you have to... They say to eliminate poverty, you'll get development dollars. But they can't develop anything. They can't eliminate poverty without the money. So it kind of is a force into reducing population.
So they've kind of cut the legs out from under the countries that they're offering this to. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yes. It's kind of, it's Orwellian. You really do have to twist your head on backwards to even understand this, because it's completely reversed in terms of any way that we think about money and economic development and the things that you do. It's perverse in a way that is just incredibly twisted.
Do you think possibly that they made it this complicated would also be to just make it that much harder for us to figure it out?
Well, it's probably a lot easier than I'm making it sound. The way I think about it is that if you take our dollar, okay, our dollar is a petrodollar. Right now it's based on the value of oil. And that goes back a long ways too, how that came about, but you know, suffice it to say that the U.S. dollar was the world reserve currency, and it was based on the value of the price of oil. We, in effect, forced other countries to buy oil using U.S. dollars, and in order to do that, they'd have to buy dollars from us to buy the oil. And that's what supported our economy in place of having something of value like gold. So if you take that understanding that our dollar was a petrodollar, multiply that times minus one, you know, to zero out the amount, then that's what your carbon credit, that's the starting point for your carbon credits. Because they are reversing the petrodollar, you will no longer... the petrodollar no longer has value. What has value is the reduction of petrol.
Okay. That is actually well stated and fairly simple. Let me just read a little bit from your actual article, Full Throttle Reverse, Reverse Engineering Civilization. In the old world order, those printed pieces of paper you have in your wallet had value. But with the financial market meltdown and the trillions of dollars created as bits in computers, beginning with the dot-com post-stock manipulation, corporate accounting fraud, trillions spent on the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the fraudulent subprime mortgages, the hundreds of billions of bailout money, followed by the hundreds of billions of economic stimulus, billions for private corporations like AIG, and their hands are out again, and another economic stimulus package waiting in the wings that will be just like the last one. What they have done is to destroy our financial system of currency. And we will never recover to our old system of currency because the people who are destroying our system are the same ones who are controlling the bailout money and implementing the new financial system. The new financial system of value for trading will be based on carbon. Everybody knows about the World Bank's plan for trading credits for reductions of CO2 emissions, but I think few people really understand that the plan is for carbon credits to be the underlying basis of value for the world financial system. And why would they understand it? It's completely and utterly insane. You have to screw your head around backwards to even think of it. It is a world financial system based on reverse engineering of civilization, full throttle reverse. So I think you stated pretty clearly there that that the petrodollar is not going to be of value in the future, but what is going to be of value is a carbon credit, which has, as you say, has the value if you're not using fossil fuels, which
yes.
is to say that you are not. Fossil fuels comprise 85% of the energy basis of all the world's economic system, and that goes for developed and undeveloped countries. If you remove fossil fuels from the, if you make it so that people have to use less fossil fuels, that means that their wealth has to go down proportionately because their economic activity goes down proportionally. So remove that 85%. That 85% is the basis for our prosperity and our wealth. So if you now put a value on using less carbon, like you say, you are reverse engineering. You're letting these people put their lever on the controlled demolition of the industrial world.
Yeah. And, you know, I understand how these people think, you know, because what they're working on are computer systems, and they've got data models. And the reason why I say, you know, you just take this number and multiply it times minus one, because I know that's what they're doing in their models. The problem is that kind of simplicity doesn't translate in the real world that we live in. You know, and when you reverse the value of the currency, change the basis of the currency to something that is a reductionist kind of thing, and even if they give us rationing coupons for energy, chances are excellent that those rationing coupons are not going to be enough to, you know, for us to have both heat and air conditioning. You know, heat in the winter and air conditioning in the summer, we'll have to choose which one we want. It's still destroying the whole basis of our economy, and it rewards destruction of the industrial economy of the past.
Vicki, doesn't that, it still sounds to me like what they're doing is rewarding those for hoarding the resources that they don't develop. Are you following what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, but I wouldn't really put it that way. If you do a search on Buckminster Fuller videos and you listen to what Buckminster Fuller says, he explains it, and the way he explains it is that they consider that we have extracted enough minerals and extracted enough of everything from the earth, and what we now need to do is to recycle and reuse everything, and we have the technology, allegedly, to be able to do that. And we have sunshine for energy and wind for power, and, you know, so we don't need to extract anything more from the earth than we already have.
And that's discounting the fact of the energy that it takes to recycle.
Well, I apparently that doesn't really factor in. And I'm not sure. But it's like I said, you know, when you break this down logically and you apply it to the real world, it doesn't make sense. It makes
sense. Well, now listen. Vicki, I proposed, sorry to interrupt, but I proposed five reasons for the global warming fraud. I've thought of another one which could relate to this, and this one might not be so bad in the sense that it might be not so evil. There's a lot of discussion out there about peak oil, the fact that the humans may have pumped out about half of the easily recoverable oil. We've pumped about 1 trillion barrels of oil since the industrial, the oil age began about 1870, and it's thought that there's about 1 trillion barrels of oil left in the ground, which are not going to be too costly to pump out. And, of course, if you've got a civilization based on fossil fuels and your supply starts going down after you've peaked in terms of your production, even as your demand is going up, which, of course, it is all over the world, everybody wants a part of the American dream and the industrial lifestyle and a car and a house with electricity, then you've got a real problem. You've got the basis for a lot of wars. You've got resource wars, which, of course, we're in right now. So could it be that this whole global warming fraud is a way to control the, shall we say, the landing of the industrial airplane as we run out of the basic resource that allowed the airplane to fly in the first place?
Well, yes, but the problem with that is that the things that they could do to move us off of a petroleum-based economy, they aren't doing those things, okay, like nuclear power. We do need to have electricity and, we need to power our economy if we're going to have an economy. They could build power plants, especially in the East, where they rely on fuel oil. But that isn't really in the game plan of the technocracy. The technocracy wants to move us back to what I guess was Thomas Edison's original idea, or the original idea for electricity, which was to have small local generation, rather than the power plants that are located in one place and utility lines running everywhere, which is, I guess, the whole idea behind the smart grid, which is to go back to a system of individual power generation. But you know, when you start looking at all of this, there are so many logical problems in what they're doing. They've drained our economy. There is no money to do this. You know, to put solar cells on your home, and I mean, they're going to do energy audits for you so that you can seal up your house, you know, so that you don't have any air leaks. But I mean, that's a minor kind of savings, unless your house is so old, you know, you don't have dual pane windows or something. But all of the things, all of the innovations that are possible to do in a modern and progressive context, they are not doing it that way. They want to take us back in time. And I don't know if you remember George Bush saying that these people want to take us back to the Stone Age or something to that effect. Well, he was telling you the truth. That is precisely what they want to do.
Well, it's interesting. Of course, I agree with that. But George Bush, the most recent George Bush II, in 2002, said we need an energy policy that encourages consumption. And the government followed suit by giving large tax breaks to people who buy Hummers. And the auto companies followed suit by killing the electric car, et cetera. But then in 2006, he did a flip-flop, and he stood up there at the State of the Union and said, gosh, we've got a problem. We're addicted to oil. And, of course, by that time, it was pretty much too late in his administration to actually do anything about it. And, of course, his family is an oil family. Their history is in the oil business. So it would appear that the ruling elite want to keep us addicted. possible to move us off into these alternatives for the last 50 years or more, maybe even the last century. But the power structure, the oligarchy, if you will, has sealed off the options towards electric cars, et cetera, which goes back 100 years, over 100 years, in order to keep us hooked on oil. Now, do you suppose that the plan always was in other words, beef up the Rockefeller wealth and the wealth of the oligarchy and the oil barons and the Seven Sisters, et cetera, the oil majors, even as they implement a larger, more draconian plan for the control of society? How would you look at that?
Well, I think is that there is a war in our own government, within our own government, between the oil people and the ecology people, the technocrats. And when you mentioned that Hummer program, I remember that Hummer program, and I think wasn't that pre 9/11 when he announced that?
I really don't know when it was announced, but I think it was in effect during the early part of this decade or the early 2000s.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think so, too, because I remember being surprised by George Bush's energy policy, and it did seem to me that it was kind of a backward step. But then, you know, I, of course, lost all of that in the whole 9/11 thing, and I never really thought about it again until just right this minute when you said that. So that would be an interesting thing to find out what the timing is on that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, okay. Yeah.
Go ahead.
So we see the big picture that you see is that there is a plan for reverse engineering civilization. Now, you say that there are warring factions within government. Do you think everybody is on board on that, or do you suppose that there are factions that are pretty strongly trying to keep our civilization together? I'm thinking of Republican Senator Inhofe, and the Republican senators have not been quick to jump on Obama's energy bill, which would include now some cap and trade, carbon trading schemes, and put us down the road towards these draconian changes. There are congressmen who have resisted this mightily. So would you say that this war is still raging then in Washington and elsewhere?
Yes, I would. They've defined the problem, but the issue is, you know, how do you solve it? The technocrats that, you know, want to implement the whole smart grid, all of the technocratic solutions, their solutions are pretty draconian, and they think that the economy can turn on a dime and just, you know, we're just going to rebuild everything, you know, in the green model, green buildings. And on the Republican side, I would say that there's a little bit more realism in terms of the realities of the economy, that there are real people out here that, you know, have to make a living and all of that stuff, although there are limits to the Republican reality, too. So, but, yeah, there are warring factions, and the issue is how do you approach these problems, and how do you design solutions to make everybody happy, you know, without, well, I don't know. What I see happening, though, is that ultimately it's going to end up probably hurting just a whole lot of people, and probably, I hate to say this, but depopulation is part of the agenda, because I don't see the green economy being able to support the population.
Right. Again, if you take away that 85% of our energy base, which is fossil fuels, or even if you reduced it significantly, you would not be able to support the modern agricultural system, which is fossil fuel intensive in every way, and you wouldn't be able to support our middle class lifestyle. So I think this could be one of the reasons why there is a concerted attempt to destroy the middle class right now. But let me go back to this idea that you put out in this paper. You say, to get an idea of how this system will work, picture a national carbon bank with each societal unit having an account. A societal unit would be a family, a town, a state, etc. The CO2 emissions of that unit would be calculated and would be recorded on the negative side of the ledger. The productivity of the unit would then be calculated and entered on the plus side of the ledger. If the net is on the plus side, it's all good, but if the net is on the negative side, then carbon credits must be purchased or obtained from someplace, or the unit must be dissolved. And then, of course, that could result in some kind of economic penalty, which would make it even harder for people to survive. And then you talk about the solution as being the asset-based community development concept, which was developed at Northwestern University. The idea is to inventory the non-tangible assets of the population within a community. Does this have anything to do with the census? I don't know. The fact that anybody would spend money on something like this to tell you how serious they are about the new system of valuation based on resource utilization. So the idea is that if your unit, be it your family or your town or whatever, creates something of value, they are rewarded, and if they don't, then they're on the negative side of the ledger. So now you have this incredible accounting system, kind of a cost-benefit analysis of the worth of each unit, and maybe grandma's not very productive or a little five-year-old Timmy's not very productive, but his lack of productivity is offset by somebody else's, but maybe not. And then what would happen if you're on the negative side?
Well, this gets so psychopathic, but I'm sure you've heard people talking about this new healthcare system and how, you know, the government basically will be doing a cost-benefit analysis on you, you know, to determine if you're worthy of a certain level of treatment. Well, that's what this, you know, family dependency ratio business is all about. They'll be doing a cost-benefit analysis on your life, on your household. How much are you producing relative to how many of the world's resources are you using? And that goes back to the calculation that the technocrats of 1934 were trying to come up with. The problem is, back in 1934, they didn't have the computers, they didn't have the capability to do it, but today they do. And all of this intrusion of government into our lives, you know, things like the American Community Survey, the Total Information Awareness, the NAIS Animal Tracking System, all of these things, the Asset-Based Community Survey, all of these things are to inventory the asset side of the ledger to be used in their calculations for relative worth versus usage of the world's resources.
Vicki, then it sounds like they're doing to us what we have done to animals that we raise for production of some sort.
Well, yes, you could think of it that way. They certainly are. I mean, you know, if you think of a rancher who has a herd of cattle, you know, he looks at his whole herd and he says, well, you know, this bull is kind of old, so, you know, we'll get rid of him and, you know, we'll promote this, you know, I'll keep this young steer to be the bull, and, you know, this cow looks kind of sickly, we'll cut her out, send her off to the glue factory, you know, that kind of thing. And that is precisely what they're doing, what they will be doing. Those are the kinds of systems that they are designing and implementing. And they wrap up the marketing into a socially acceptable language. But if you get down to the core of the systems and you look at the entire global system that they have planned, it's a triage system. It's a human resource management system. It is a global totalitarian management system. And ultimately, it will be used to cull the population and to make more efficient use of resources. And I think it was Club of Rome that said they want to get the world population down to about 500 million or so?
Yeah, there are different documents that talk about targets. I think the UN itself said that the Earth could support about 1 million at the 1 billion at the level of North American consumption, and maybe 2 to 3 billion at the level of European consumption. And then others, you know, such as Ted Turner and various other environmental types, have talked about lower numbers, like 500 million years and et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
500 million people instead of the present 6.8 billion or whatever we got.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, it sounds...
So who are these people that are playing God and that think that they should play God and deciding who should live and who should die? Can we identify these people? Or are they just all nameless, faceless bureaucrats?
No, they have names. Cass Sunstein, Peter Orszag. Peter Orszag is the director of the OMB, and I just recently did some more research showing the legislation, trying to explain to people how this whole technocratic subterranean layer of the, which really is the New World Order, this technocratic administrative layer of government. They are the New World Order. And in 1996, the legislation that was passed, first it looked like that it was part of the national, it was part of the National Defense Reauthorization legislation, but it applied to the entire government. And what they did was to reorganize the government in such a way that they put the Office of Management and Budget as the lead agency in charge of the chief information officers of each of the agencies of government. And those people were authorized to redesign our systems of government. So that's really where the power of government is, and if you look at those people, those are the people who I put on the list of technocrats to look at.
Could you give us some names again, please?
Yeah, Peter Orszag.
H-O-R-Z-A-K?
O-R-S-Z-A-G.
Okay.
Yeah, actually, you can go on my website, and I just finished a piece called Technocratic Coup d'Etat, and I have a link on there to the org chart for the Office of Management and Budget.
You know, to try to find out who done it has been a kind of a driving interest for many of us who've done the 911, tried to get an understanding of what really happened on 911, and now I'm of course zeroing in not only on 911 but the whole global warming thing, figuring that the groups and the individuals behind these two frauds, these operational frauds, are at least key to some extent in the power structure. Now, this book that I mentioned right at the beginning, Stranger Than Fiction, An Independent Investigation of the True Culprits Behind 911, written by Albert Pastor, came out in 2003. And he said basically it's the Zionist power structure in America which carried out the operation and covered it up. And Dr. James Fetzer, who Melody and I interviewed a few weeks ago, who founded the Scholars for 911 Truth, has also come to this conclusion. So it would appear that at least part of the operation has got a Zionist Zionism or Zionist agents or or individuals behind it. It would seem that the global warming fraud really coming out of Britain, because we're hearing every night on BBC, which is the kind of the British propaganda, British government propaganda program, a lot of this is coming out of the UN and Britain. So it would seem that the major components of this worldwide effort to bring us into this new world order include Israel and Britain, as well as certainly elements in our government. Could you comment on that?
I would say that's true, but I still would put the United States and the Soviet Union as being the leaders, and it's just that the European Union is about 5 or 6 years ahead of us in terms of implementing all of this nasty stuff. And so, but of course, there are people in Great Britain too who are complicit in this whole global scam. It's kind of like a network of technocratic ecologists, if you want to call them that, scientists and engineers and politicians that have in mind to basically control, manage the globe technocratically. And BP, I just this morning, I woke up this morning and I heard Rosa DeLauro, she's a congresswoman from Connecticut, and she was talking about legislation that she's proposed called the National Infrastructure Bank, because they plan on rebuilding our whole country. You know, green buildings, green schools, green, green, green. And so she's proposing the legislation for this infrastructure bank. So I did a search on her, because this is not the first piece of legislation that she's implemented sponsored that had to do with systems. She was behind the legislation for the food safety system, you know, that would even reach down into your own garden, you know, because your garden is part of the food chain. So anyway, I did a search on her, and turns out she was Chris Dodd's chief of staff before she was elected to Congress in 1990. Chris Dodd, of course, is the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee. Well, DeLauro was married to this guy named Greenberg, and Greenberg is a lobbyist, a very powerful lobbyist in Washington, D.C. I went to their website, and I found where BP is one of their clients. They did a case study on BP for, quote, rebranding BP to be one of the leaders in the new energy economy. And that's too much of a coincidence with the, you know, what they did off the coast of Louisiana for me. You know, I kind of was snide about it. I called it a coinky dink. but the fact is that kind of a connection, you know, where they blow up an oil rig in Louisiana and, you know, destroy lots of, basically destroy Louisiana's economy, and with them being connected to this whole global technocratic system, proposing the infrastructure bank. I mean, it's a dialectic. You know, let me just be straight on that. It's a dialectic. And
you know, I appreciate that. Now, one more possible cause for the global warming fraud that I have thought of, and so has Dr. Judy Wood, who is, I think, one of the premier researchers into 911, is that it may be a cover for geoengineering. Weather modification and HAARP-type modification of our environment. In other words, if we have a perceived crisis, even Obama has said, well, we may have to do some geoengineering projects to save us from this this terrible warming threat. Of course, a lot of people have surmised or at least speculated that the Hurricane Katrina, which seems to have had a very strange course and, of course, hit New Orleans dead on, that this may have been teleguided by HAARP technology, which is basically Tesla technology, 100 years later come to fruition, and that's pretty easily demonstrable through patents by a guy named Bernard Eastland, et cetera, who's admitted that this is Tesla technology, and that they can use it to guide hurricanes, they can use it to create earthquakes, they can use it for penetrating tomography and all kinds of things. And we now have some 20 of these stations around the world which can send these extremely low-frequency waves into the ionosphere and bounce them down to anywhere. So do you think it's possible that the geoengineering is part of the matrix here?
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly possible. I mean, it's very odd that Haiti was hit by not just one earthquake, but two earthquakes. So, yeah, it's possible, but I don't have enough of a science background to really speak to that with any kind of credibility. You know, the computer systems, the information systems, I understand those inside out, and I can list, you know, about 10 global systems that they're implementing, and I can tell you how those systems all fit into the big picture.
But, could you do that then? Yeah, could you do that?
Could I do that?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, the global health, the Gemini, which is the global emergency management incident system. It's not called that in our country. It's called FEMA, but it's all connected. There is the global supply chain, which includes it's a global transportation system that they have worked out, and the corridors, the smart highways throughout our country, they are part of that global transportation system. There is the of course the NAIS animal tracking system, and all of the inventory systems are part of it. And I don't know whether you remember, but Nancy Pelosi said we're going to inventory everything. Well, that's part of the global system, because in order to control the world, they've got to inventory everything. The internet itself is like the central nervous system, the backbone for the entire global system. Okay, there is the global library system, all of the libraries linked together so that, you know, theoretically at least all the information will be available to you, you know, as an individual. Our government was even working with businesses to establish supply chains. You know, helping businesses to establish their supply chains. The problem, of course, with that is that a supply chain is a monopoly, and it puts businesses that are not in the supply chain out of business. So basically, they have destroyed our economy with this efficiency of the global system. There is the global maritime system. As a matter of fact, in one of my one of the first five pieces that's on my website, I have a list of the global systems that they listed at the G7 summit in Brussels in 1995 that they were going to work on. The systems that I know about, which includes the education system, the integrated education workforce development system, which includes America's Job Bank and America's Talent Bank, those are global systems. So, you know, if I look through my website, I know I have more that I'm not thinking of at the moment. But I mean, this whole plan, it is massive, absolutely massive what they are doing.
The first one you mentioned of the Global Computer Information Systems was global what? Sounded like global hell.
Well, it is. All of it together is global hell, because they are building in such efficiency into these global systems that they plan on having the world operate like a shop floor. Shop floor efficiency for the world.
So, Vicki, is this you're saying this, and it's done in pretty much a virtual way? Because one of the things that I found out, I went down to Texas to do some research, and I found that often what was on the computers didn't even match up at all with what was in some of the records that I was going through with some of these counties and courts and that sort. But it doesn't really matter if that's all they're operating off of, correct?
Well, it matters from the standpoint of, like, the subprime meltdown. I mean, what they were trying to do, apparently a big part of that problem was that they were using an online system to input loan applications, only there weren't any edits, or they knew how to get, you know, these people knew how to get by the edits. And they were also doing property title searches and things using an online system. And I forget the name of the company that has that online system that they thought that all of the tax records and titles and conditions and whatever were on that system. But I think a big part of the subprime meltdown problem was that, you know, they were issuing loans not only far in excess of the actual value of the property, but they were issuing loans on property that didn't even exist.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I was finding out, is that what was being put into those records didn't necessarily match up.
Right. Well, that's part of the problem with their thinking. You see, inside of a corporation, everybody that's working inside of a corporation is all working on the same team. And the corporation has control, and if somebody messes up, you can fire them. But when you're trying to run your government and the world using a system that is effectively a corporate computer system, and you are depending on the honesty and integrity of everybody using the system, you've got a real problem. I mean, it just can't work. It can't work, you know, because there are people in the world who are dishonest.
You know, talking about the importance of computers and going back to the idea of the global warming fraud, in fact, the quote-unquote evidence that is being used or at least the information, quote-unquote, that's being used to promote the fears, all based on computer models. And these are very sophisticated computers that assume in the assumptions of the models that carbon dioxide is the main driver of climate change, and that natural climate change is not important and doesn't have an impact. So right there, garbage in, garbage out. If your assumptions are wrong, your conclusions are going to be wrong. Fact is, for the last 300 years, the Earth's temperature has been rising at a rate of about a half a degree centigrade per century, because we're still coming out of the Little Ice Age, which was a natural cold period, which followed a natural warm period called the medieval warm period. But so from a scientific point of view, and in terms of the real world, we can show that that has not deviated much for the last 300 years, even though humans have started to burn fossil fuels more than before. But all of the alarm then comes from manipulating the inputs into this system and all trying to get all the climate data in these models, and then making projections for what might happen over the next century. So the projections then are being used to scare us, and they're not based on anything more than these computer models. So I think that's a case of virtual reality trumping real reality.
It certainly is, and that all started with the Club of Rome, and they got this guy named Forrester at MIT. They're blaming it on him that he proposed using setting up a world model, and so the Club of Rome went along with it. I don't know how true that is, you know, that Forrester actually suggested it. But either way, they spent 2 years in 1972 building this model of the world's resources. Well, and that's what Club of Rome used for their book, Limits to Growth. Well, first of all, you know, in 1972, they didn't have the data, they didn't have the computing power, and 2 years is not enough time to do anything other than to build the model. So basically what they were demonstrating was the use of models, not a real model of the world's resources. And so basically the whole thing about resource utilization started out as a fraud. And computer, yeah, as you say, computer models are only as good as the data put into them, and they are only as good as the programmer who wrote it.
Let me go ahead and say you're listening to Truth Quest with Melody on KHEN LPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community-supported radio, and we're streamed on the Internet at khen.org. And if you would like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest with Melody, they are available at www.givemesometruth.info or link from the khen.org website. And this evening, my co-host is Dr. Eric Carlstrom, and our special guest is Vicki Davis. Go ahead.
And you're right about all of them using computer models. I know the Federal Reserve uses models. Our government uses models. I did this little project, you know, looking at the Social Security tax receipts for a 10-year period. And I'm sorry, hold. Can you hold on a sec? I've got to switch phones.
Okay.
Okay, are you there?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
You had that set up.
Yeah, my battery was beeping. Anyway, I did this project where I went out and I got the Social Security accounting reports from the Social Security Administration, where they report the actual tax receipts for Social Security, and that's a fixed percentage, and there is absolutely no reason to use a model or any kind of anything other than the actual statistics on Social Security tax receipts. But what I found is that they were using an economic model, and you can tell because they go up by a very similar percentage every year. The problem with it is that those statistics went up during the 2001, 2002, 2003 time frame when we had massive, massive job loss. And you don't, when you have massive job losses, your Social Security tax receipts don't go up. They go down. So it's easily demonstrable that the government is using models. Wall Street was using models for the subprime. Federal Reserve is using models. So basically what we've had for I don't know how long is a totally fictional representation of the economy.
And then we trust them with anything else?
I wouldn't trust them with anything, actually. Not with what I've found out, because they're just simply not being truthful with us. And I don't know, you know, how many members of Congress actually understand this, but, you know, I have recordings from one hearing where Jim Nussle was the chairman of the Budget Committee in the House, and he was getting testimony from the Congressional Budget Office director, and the the Congressional Budget Office director explained their model, how their model of worked, you know, for determining what the congressional what revenues were that the Congress could spend. And he said he didn't know about that, and he said he thought that the majority of the members of Congress didn't know about it either. So there you have it.
Are you familiar with them, a model being made on water, and that they've got some kind of things maybe somewhat similar to carbon trading? I don't know if it's going to be used as a commodity in the same manner, but that they will be measuring, you know, how much water it takes, you know, to grow something and then to move it elsewhere. Are you familiar with this at all?
I heard something the other day about virtual water.
Yeah, that's it.
Okay, and that goes along with the what computer systems do is, you know, when you design a computer system, the objective is to aggregate all of the functions and streamline everything to make it efficient. And what these people, these global modelers, these analysts who are designing global systems have done, they, rather than correcting world problems, they're correcting their own reports. And what they've done with this whole virtual water system thing, and I okay, now this is just based on my instincts and knowing everything else that they're doing, but they have said, you know, there are some parts of the world that don't have any water. We have lots of water, so we have a model of water, you know, water resources in the countries. So in order to make things equitable so that everybody has a share of everything, and to make their reports balance, they've come up with this virtual water system. So if we have excess water and some other country doesn't have any water, then we have to pay them for the water that they don't have.
I saw some really bizarre calculations with it. It's been probably about a year since I went in and checked out this on the web, on the internet, and it was pretty bizarre.
Yeah, well, it's all about redistribution, you know. They can't really redistribute the water, so they came up with a virtual water system. So we have to buy our own water from them.
Right.
I mean, how crazy is that?
Well, that kind of goes along with them breaking down the sovereignty of all these countries and the like, so that they can transport this without all the technicalities involved that would normally be involved otherwise.
Yeah. Well, the minute they passed the legislation for the World Trade Organization, sovereignty was lost. It's gone. You know, so the only thing that will get our sovereignty back is to get out of all these global systems and get rid of everybody who even remotely, even marginally, supports any of it.
You've got a quote here called the parasitic. You've got a section here in a paper that you wrote called "War in the Context of Everything Else: Slave Masters Rise Again," and then the heading is "The Parasitic Usurpers," which is an interesting choice of words because that's one that Eustace Mullins used as well in his book, The World Order, the hegemony of parasitism. You say regionalization is the strategy of the parasitic usurpers, regardless of whether you're looking at the international arena or within the domestic arena. The idea is to corrode power from legitimate and lawful authority, handing it over to the hidden power structure of the parasites. The parasites then dictate policy from behind the curtain, just as the marionette makes the puppet dance. And then you give a little block flow chart here, which shows at the top the U.S. State Department, the Council on Foreign Relations, the United Nations, and then the EU power structure, the National Security Council, CIA, Council on Economic Advisors, NATO liaison, U.S. Trade Representatives, and then near the bottom, the American puppet president. Is that how you would still draw the power diagram, or would you care to place some individuals or figures above the U.S. State Department, the CFR, and the UN?
Well, I probably would draw it a little bit differently now, because the United Nations is kind of a pass-through. It's another public space, you know, for the power behind the scenes. And so I would leave the State Department and the CIA the way that I have them, because the State Department really is the international coordinator with the international system. And that's where the U.S. Trade Representative is, and, of course, the CIA. They are the, well, they do a couple of different things, but, I mean, they kind of seem to me like that they work for these psychopathic bankers that, you know, are implementing all of these policies, these global policies. So I would leave them pretty much where they are. The international organizations like the International Institute for Systems Analysis, I think they have a lot more power than what they are perceived to have, because they were started as a government initiative between the United States and the Soviet Union. And they are hidden, you know. They are not out there in full view. Organizations like the Paris Club and the Club of Budapest, and of course the IMF and the World Bank. Those organizations, I think, are really where the power is. The power is where the money is. All things emanate from where the money is. And so
there's a book by David Rothkopf this year called The Super Class, The Global Power Elite and the World They Are Making. And he talks about how he says this super class is comprised of about 6,000 on a planet of 6 billion. They run our governments, our largest corporations, the powerhouses of international finance, the media, the world religions, and from the shadows, the world's most dangerous criminal and terrorist organizations. They are the global superclass, and they are shaping our history. He says they have unprecedented levels of wealth and power. They have globalized more rapidly than any other group. He includes in his superclass a lot of our politicians and our leaders. I would argue that he is he's giving us what the CIA would call a limited hangout. That the 6,000 that he's mentioning are indeed the puppets of the real superclass, which is generally not so well seen or acknowledged, or they're better hidden. And we interviewed Joan Vion last week, and she says that with the Princess Diana, with her marriage to Prince Charles, you have the merging of the House of Windsor, the royal house of the royal family of England, with the House of Rothschild, which of course the Jewish banking elite that really has gotten its tentacles now into all the central banks of the world, controlling each country through controlling the currency of each country. And so she would kind of place the center of this power structure with the British royal family and the Zionist agenda. Would you take it that far, or would you still want to stick with these institutional units?
Well, the people that you mentioned, you know, the British royal, they're the people with the money, and there's probably, you know, I don't know how many people that would, you know, qualify in that circle, but I'd say it's probably under 100. And so the 6,000 that the other guy was referring to, I would say probably that would include the members that, you know, the people that go to Davos. And the World Economic Forum, that's a group of about 1,000 people that represent the largest corporations in the world. So they're very significant, and they are the in large part the technocrats that control the technology that is being implemented. So, I mean, there's a lot of power at Davos when those people meet. But so I'd say they're both right. It just depends on how you define the centers of power. You know, from my point of view, you know, from where I sit, I would look at it and say there are about 6,000 or so people that control the world. And then you've got the inner circle with the money that drive everything. So that would be the Rothschilds and the House of Windsor and, the Zionists, out of Russia, the Russian oligarchs. And so that's how I would break it down.
Yeah, and of course, this knowledge that there, or if it is true, or this speculation, this hypothesis that we've just put forward, if it's true, then we can start to see the where this power is coming from and who is wielding it. Now, what good does that do us as individuals trying to preserve some semblance of a lifestyle and freedom for the average citizen of the world?
It doesn't do us any good, but at least we can, as long as we keep talking and trying to explain things to our fellow citizens in such a way that they can see the global system and they can point to people that are responsible for it, then I think maybe we can get somewhere. And what it really kind of annoys me, about a lot of the alternate media is that they're always talking about secret societies and stuff like this. And yes, I know they exist, but the minute that you say secret society, the big rubber stamp conspiracy theorist comes out, you get stamped on your forehead. And I think it acts as kind of a diversion, frankly, because there are very real people that are involved in this that you can point to, that you can say, this guy is a globalist, he's working on the global systems, and the agenda is depopulation, and here is what he said, like Cass Sunstein. You can go read what he said.
What's the name again, Vicki? What's the name?
Cass Sunstein.
I could you spell that?
C-A-S-S space S-U-S-S-T-E-I-N. S-U-S-S-T-E-I-N. Something like that.
Cass Sunstein?
Sunstein, yeah. You can see it on the org chart of the Obama White House, of the org chart of the OMB.
Something I heard this morning on one program is that they were making reference kind of lightheartedly, but somewhat seriously, in the fact that some of these countries like Iceland or Greece we're getting information that these people are rioting and whatever, but it sounds like the people are starting to figure out what's going on, and they're wanting to go after some of the bankers that are involved in some of these funding of systems or taking off with funds. So maybe, they're starting to get it, that holding these people accountable. And to me, that is a huge step forward.
Yeah, well, they have a lot smaller population, so they're kind of closer to their bankers than we are. but yeah, I hope so. I mean, I would hope so. And I wish that we could, do some. Every single person at Goldman Sachs needs to be arrested, along with Christopher Dodd, chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, because I believe that they colluded to create this financial crisis in our country, and I believe that they colluded to extort money from from the Congress to start this National Infrastructure Bank. And I don't know this to be true, but I'm just guessing. I know that Christopher Dodd is going to retire from the Senate this year, and I'll bet you anything that if this legislation passes to create the National Infrastructure Bank, Chris Dodd will be the chairman of it, and he will basically become the dictator of the United States.
Oh, what webs we weave.
Yeah.
Well, Vicki, you've touched on the financial crisis, and I imagine you have some information about that. Could you give us your, now that we've had the benefit of a year or two to kind of let the dust settle a little, can you tell us what you think happened?
Yeah, I think it was all engineered. I traced that back to, well, of course, the WTO agreement, the Marrakesh Agreement that was approved in 1995 that created the World Trade Organization that included trade in services, that was a big part of it. And, of course, they exported a lot of our high-dollar jobs. At the same time that was going on, Robert Rubin, who was Treasury Secretary, and he set up all these programs, you know, for community reinvestment and the programs for small businesses and government contracting and all of that sort of thing, you know, which is supposed to fund the what I would call the revolutionary forces from the bottom, fund them from the bottom, as they destroy the middle class. You know, they disempowering the middle class, empowering the people from the bottom to take over, just in, you know, classic revolution. And so, and I do think that the whole financial debacle, the whole subprime meltdown was intentional. It was set up to do exactly what they did.
And who would you see as these revolutionary forces from the bottom?
The illegal aliens, the minorities from the bottom.
So they don't even know they're playing that role.
No, I don't think they do. And the problem is that they think they're getting something. But what they're getting, what they will be getting, is a global system of totalitarian control. So the, you know, they're just being used. I don't think they have any idea, you know, about. I don't think very many people have any idea about any of this, actually. But as far as the administrative systems of government and the knowledge jobs, people are being imported from India, and they are also part of it, and I doubt very much that they understand it either. So it doesn't really matter, you know, where they came from, you know, whether they're Russians or Chinese or Mexicans that walked across the border, or the objective is to disempower the existing American middle class and replace them with foreigners, who are the revolutionary forces.
Well, that's interesting. Of course, we are, you know, historically a nation of immigrants, so people can always just say, well, it's just this is who we are, so we will continue to be who we are. And not see that as a problem.
Yeah. Well, over the last there's a website called Zazona.com. That's Z-A-Z-O-N-A. And that guy who runs that, Rob Sanchez, was an engineer, and when he couldn't find a job, you know, he started writing about it. And he's got a whole section on his website of what he calls the shortage shouters, the scofflaws that shout shortage. And what they are is letters, articles, testimonials of corporations and people and, you know, members of government that have been saying, you know, for the last decade and a half, we've got shortages in everything. So we have to massively import people because either, you know, for the blue-collar jobs, Americans are too lazy to do those jobs, you know, the jobs that Americans just won't do. And then the knowledge jobs, programmers, engineers, teachers, nurses, blah, 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 there are shortages of everything. And so basically what they're doing, they are using that as a propaganda strategy to replace Americans in the workforce. Yeah. So it's kind of like a reverse colonization, you know.
But it's not like it isn't manufactured for that to happen. I mean, I think the immigrants have been used for a long, long time in various parts of our history as well, and at this point in time, it appears that, you know, they create the dissatisfaction in the workplace, treat the employees as bad as they can so that they leave, and then start, you know, crying shortages.
Well, it's even worse than that. I mean, they actually brought in foreigners and had their American employees train their own replacements.
Right.
I mean, I've known a lot of people, you know, that where that was the case. And what's happening now and what has been happening from the 1990s forward is something different than what occurred in our past in terms of immigration. You see, when they passed the legislation to create the World Trade Organization, they included trade in services, and a service is a job or a person. I mean, you know, it's a synonym in terms of trade. So basically, they eliminated our borders when they signed the World Trade Organization, because anybody from anywhere can just, you know, come in here, and if they say that they are a service provider, providing, you know, they're in business and they're providing a service, they basically have a right to stay in the United States under the WTO agreement for trade and services. Now, you know, which conflicts with our domestic law, you know, which is, everything is just, you know, such an incredible mess.
I wonder how many people are aware of that, about that particular interpretation of what that WTO means.
Well, the people that I know online, the programmers and engineers who are no longer working, they know about it. Anybody that knows me knows about it, because I've been, you know, screaming about it for a long time, ever since I discovered it.
It seems like we could almost look at this whole thing, step back a bit, and you know, go back 500 years, and here's a continent, a magnificent, beautiful continent, North America, which is, of course, occupied by Native Americans, who maybe 20 or 30 million strong, who have developed a lifestyle over the past 12 or 13,000 years, you know, partly agrarian, partly hunting and gathering. And then we have the colonization of North America and the conquest of North America by Europeans, and this process, which takes about 500 years, the individuals who are trying to make a living wind up developing the resources of this country. We wind up, you know, putting in networks of roads and communication, et cetera. And now the whole thing is ripe for the taking for the real power elite, which perhaps was the driving factor in the colonization in the first place, to come in and take it from the people who thought they owned it. It could be that then there's 6,000 or 100 or however many people that have really their hands on the control levers, which is the, I guess, the central banks, they want the whole enchilada, not only this continent, but the others as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They want to control the entire globe. I mean, you know, they want to be the rulers of the world. It wasn't enough for them that, you know, they ruled their own countries or that they ruled the continent that they were on. They want the whole planet. And so I guess you could say, you know, that I don't go back 500 years, you know, because that was a different time, a different era, you know, and the world was being explored. They didn't know where, you know, they didn't have the whole world mapped out, and, you know, it could be that their objectives were to control the whole world. I don't know. But
maybe the world was just a different size to them.
Under the global system, nobody will own anything. And that's another thing, is that the Indians, the indigenous peoples, are being led to believe that they're getting their land back. Well, no, they aren't. They're being used in the same way that the illegals are being used, in the same way that the Indians are being used, and everybody is going to end up in the same boat of a global slave management system.
Would you comment on the human settlement proposals of the United Nations and the Wildlands Project, which of course are part of the original Biodiversity Treaty of the Rio Earth Summit, wherein the cover story, of course, was we're going to preserve ecosystems and habitat for the big, you know, the big ungulates, the deer and the elk and the predators like grizzly bears and mountain lions, et cetera. We're going to put a lot of habitat away so that we can have a healthy ecosystem. That would involve mainly locking up about 50% of the United States and basically taking it away from the individuals that own that land and use the land for resources, so that under the cover then of the environmental movement, we have this massive transfer of resources and land back to the centralized control of, I guess, whoever controls the system, so that the whole idea of core reserves and corridors and whatnot that all sounded so good from an environmental viewpoint is just part of a plan to take control of resources in this country.
Right. Well, and it's all part of the central planning. I mean, you know, they want people all together in the mega cities, what they call the, you know, mega regions, and in the planned communities, which will be the stack 'em and pack 'em buildings. You know, basically, if you think about putting people in the zoo and letting the animals roam free, that's the idea behind the human settlements.
Yeah.
And what was the other thing that you mentioned?
Well, of course, the environmental movement is the cover, kind of the warm and fuzzy wrapping, which allows this program to go forward.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And it won't be that the wildlands will be unavailable for use. They just won't be available for use by the peasants, which includes us. You know, the world's elite will have their playgrounds in the, you know, in the best places in the world, but
they're already doing that, aren't they?
Off limits to people.
They're already doing that.
In speculating, I have two questions for you. Because you are, you know, you're looking at the big picture like Joan Vion is, and it's really great to talk to somebody who has such a wide understanding. But can you speculate as to how far away we are from this world totalitarian system in which our freedoms are gone?
Well, I would say probably about 2 decades.
Two decades, if that. Okay, then let me ask.
Yeah, because they are moving really fast on this, and something that they need to have, everybody in the world have, you know, a chip, either in an ID. They need to be able to ID everybody, and they are working hard to get people off of the rural lands, you know, using various means. But I would say that every year that goes by, there is less and less mobility in terms of your ability to live free, start a business, have the resources that you need. Every year that goes by, there is less and less. And it's because of the way that they've set up the world economic system, our economic system, it's a system of attrition, of creative destruction. I don't think it's very creative, but basically a system of deconstruction of the civilization that we now have.
Vicki, I find it interesting that you think it's that far away. I would have, if that would have been put to me, I would have figured we were either there or it's right around the corner.
Mm-hmm. Well, they've got a lot of work to do in terms of implementing the systems. I mean, they just recently passed the healthcare legislation, and even though those systems are all ready to go, it takes quite a while to have systems, mammoth systems like the ones in the United States, involves, you know, tens of hundreds of thousands of people. It takes a while to get everybody moving in a different direction. It's kind of like I use the analogy of turning the Titanic. Okay, and so they it takes a while to do that. And the systems are all basically ready to go, but they just have to now get the people turned around and herded and going in the right direction.
That's the importance of what we're doing. We're trying to get the people not to turn around and go in the right direction, right?
Right. We're working on, you know, letting them know what's going on so that they break up, run.
Yeah.
Don't stay in the herd.
Yeah, again, Joan Vian is great on this. She's been saying for years that world government isn't coming, it's here, and she's talked about all the international meetings she's been going to, et cetera. But another question that has to do with this kind of total control, one world government that is being envisioned for us by our self-appointed ruling elite. There was a great series that came on TV by Ken Burns about our national parks, a five-part series. I don't know if you saw it. And, of course, a lot of us regard national parks as one of the real bennies of being an American. And I'm 60, and I've been able to see some of the most beautiful places in the world and spend a lot of time in them. So it has certainly benefited me. They talk about the importance of John D. Rockefeller II and his purchasing of large amounts of area around the Tetons, et cetera. And now I'm wondering if, perchance, that the reason why very rich individuals like him were willing to purchase these fabulous places had to do with a plan that they were putting together even back then, back in the 30s and the 40s. In other words, that the power elite, the really rich, would put up land under public designations temporarily, which would make it easier for them to control those lands later.
Yes, I think so, because those parks are part of the UN system now.
Right, the World Heritage Sites, et cetera.
Heritage areas. Yeah, and all of the countries in the world have their designated heritage areas, and you know, basically they put it in a global conservatory, and so I'm sure they did do that to protect them and to be able to keep people out of them, but of course, you know, they will always be allowed access to them. It's like you know, in Idaho. Idaho has the primitive area right in the center of the state, and you can't drive a car in there. All you can do is backpack in if you want to go in there. But in the center there somewhere, there's a really nice resort that if you know where it is, you can fly in. So
That's actually in a wilderness area?
Yeah, it's in the wilderness area.
So that's a pretty good indication that there's a two-tiered system, one for you and me and one for the power elite.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Well, I guess the point I would make is that, number one, it's a wonderful series by Ken Burns, and it makes you feel all warm and fuzzy and good about being an American. but, of course, he does not explore this dimension of things at all. They do feature, you know, average individuals who maybe work for the Park Service or have visited the parks, and they make it all seem very, very, very democratic and a wonderful American ideal and a wonderful American experiment. But what you and I are talking about is the fact that maybe that this wonderful American development of national parks was a bit of a ruse, in the sense that it was never intended to stay with the American people, or do you think that it was and that there's been a power struggle and the American people are losing that power struggle?
No, I don't think it was intended to stay. Well, I don't know. I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't say that, but I grew up near Yellowstone Park, and when I was a teenager, when I was a kid, the people who worked in the park were people that lived in the surrounding areas. And when I graduated from high school in 1969, a girlfriend and I went up to West Yellowstone and got jobs, you know, working in West Yellowstone. And some of the kids got jobs working for the Park Service. Well, sometime in the 1970s, it was changed, and they started importing people from all over the world to work in our parks. And if you go to the parks now, at least Yellowstone Park, you'll notice that people wear name tags, and they say where they came from. And a lot of the people that work there come from out of the country.
Oh, I absolutely agree, and this is something that I have noticed as well. I was at the Chaco Canyon National Monument a couple years ago, and I had studied archaeology when I was a student back in the late 60s, and gone on tours of all our great Indian ruins in the Southwest, and there was a young lady from Rome who was our tour guide, and she couldn't have been, you know, more than 21 or 22, and of course, I've been in that area and studied those kinds of issues most of my adult life, or at least off and on in my adult life. And here's this young Italian doing the explaining. And I recently saw at the Gila National Monument in New Mexico, our tour guide was from England. You know, again, a nice, attractive young woman from England was the expert. So, yeah, we are being recolonized or decolonized or something like that. It would seem in some ways that we are, that our good spots are being, to some extent, co-managed and usurped by international.
Did Ken Burns get into some of our parks being UN-controlled?
No. He didn't talk about that.
No, of course not. He wouldn't mention that. I mean, they don't tell the people in this country anything. They frame everything so very carefully to make it appear to be that everything in the United States is normal. But there's nothing normal, absolutely nothing normal about what's going on in this country. This is not the same country I grew up in. And I'm not sure exactly at what point we lost it, but I would say, you know, a good guess would be when Lyndon Johnson was president was the beginning.
Well, and another good guess, I think, you know, of course, we can only refer to our own experience, but I was 13 when John F. Kennedy was assassinated, and that was obviously done by the shadow government, you know, the shadow government showed its hand. It shows its hand during these extraordinary crimes, that being one of them. And of course, they were never found guilty or prosecuted. So I'm sure it goes back before 1963. But from what I understand, John F. Kennedy had made some executive orders. I think 11110 executive order was to nationalize the money supply and give the government again the power to print currency, which of course the central bankers, the Rothschilds, the City of London, Wall Street wouldn't tolerate that. So he was assassinated, and then on the very plane when Lyndon Johnson was flying back from Dallas to Washington D.C., he rescinded that executive order with another executive order that kept the money supply in the hands of this private central bank, the Federal Reserve, and the individuals that run the Federal Reserve. So, I mean, that's just one of the reasons probably why Kennedy was assassinated. Another having to do with, well, I won't go on about that. But, yeah, going back to when we lost this country, that moment seems pivotal to me, and ironically, I was only 13 years old when it happened. So,
yeah. Well, I was 12, and I would agree with you. I that's one area that I really haven't studied, but I am positive that it has to do with the global controllers, which of course is includes these international banksters, you know, of the IMF. And the reason why I say that is because I was looking at the history of the IMF this morning. And I'd already done a piece called The Ghost of Morgenthau Haunts Our House. And the Morgenthau Plan was the plan for post-World War II Germany. And what I'd read about that was that it was an extraordinarily draconian plan where they planned to deindustrialize Germany, to turn it into a pastoral state. Meaning just basically agriculture. And when you read about it, and I mean, I see the parallels with what they're planning to do with our economy, turn our country into a pastoral state. Okay, but Herbert Hoover went over to Germany and did a study, and he determined that in order to implement the Morgenthau Plan, 25 million people would have to die in order for the plan to work. Well, it turns out that the Morgenthau Plan, Henry Morgenthau was our Secretary of the Treasury, and he worked out this arrangement with the Allies post-World War II. And the counter to the Morgenthau Plan was the Marshall Plan. Okay, Hoover came back and they did an emergency meeting and they set up the Marshall Plan to rebuild Germany so that Germany would have an option to not use the funds of the IMF, which turns out to be the International Monetary Organization that presented the Morgenthau Plan. Okay, so if you tracing the history of the IMF and looking at the history as it's written, that organization began and always was an organization of psychopaths who were determined to deindustrialize the world, turn the world into a pastoral state, and apparently Germany was going to be first, you know, one of the first, because they were an industrial giant in the 1930s, or they became one.
Go ahead.
Well, they became one because that's where all the coal resources are, and so, you know, they started with weapons, and they built an incredible economy, and the Brits and the Soviets and the U.S., I guess, wanted them taken down.
Well, you know, in this book, Stranger Than Fiction, An Independent Investigation of the True Culprits Behind 911 by Albert D. Pastor, It's a short book written in 2003, and it's amazing that he came to these, I think, fairly accurate conclusions so fast while the rest of us were still trying to figure out what happened. He talks about the role of the Zionist Jews in getting the United States into both World War I and World War II, and probably for setting the conditions that would cause the wars in the first place, because, of course, wars are the most profitable business for central bankers. And of course, Henry Morgenthau, that you mentioned as a very powerful player at the end of World War II, he's also a Zionist Jew. So I guess, at the risk of being labeled one of these conspiracy theorists, I think I'm a conspiracy realist when I say that, we do have a program. It's been called the Universal Jewish Conspiracy for Jews to run the world, and they say they have some biblical justification for that, because they think the chosen people, and of course Israel has turned into an incredibly racist state, which the only person that can actually live in Israel and get citizenship has to be Jewish. So I think that there is some reason to believe that what we're looking at here is the fruition of a Zionist program, which is to take over the world for this one religion, or at least people who are claiming that one religion. I don't think that they are very good Jews. It's a very evil program, but I think they are kind of embedded within the Jewish community, and they get some support from it. And
I have to agree with you. I avoided any looking at, you know, the Zionist Jewish conspiracy kinds of things, you know, because I wanted names, I wanted things that were done and people who did them and when they did them. But, you know, I have to say I keep running into these really significant people in this whole thing that just happen to be Jewish Zionists. So I agree with you. You know, it does appear that that's the case.
Yeah.
And
when I asked this question to Joan Vion, she said, well, you know, she agreed with me as well, and she says, and I'm going to be called anti-Semitic for saying this, but blah, blah, blah. And, of course, that's one of the ways that people are controlled, to not say anything that could be construed as against people who are Jewish. But that, you know, she goes on to say that, you know, she's from Italy, and she has no compunction about talking about the Italian mafia. What we're dealing with, I guess, is a Jewish Zionist mafia, which, of course, does not include all Jews, but which is extremely powerful.
Yeah, well, and if you actually look at the history of our country, the Jewish mafia was tied very closely with the Italian mafia here. And while we're on the subject of Zionism, Zionism being connected to communism, and I think they're just con artists, frankly, that con artists that have wrapped their criminal activity in a philosophy and a religion.
There you go. Yeah.
And so you end up, you know, not being able to talk about it because of the political correctness of the Fabian socialists, and supposedly if you even mention the word Jewish, then you're anti-Semitic and, you know, you're picking on the Jews. Well, no, I'm not picking on the Jews. I've known some really, you know, I've had some great friends that were Jewish. What I am saying is that there is a criminal mob that have had a plan to control the world, you know, probably throughout history. And they're criminals.
Would you say that that's part of also what's involved in the Soviet Union, is that same group?
Yes,
sorts?
I would. Okay. Yes, I would.
I don't think there's any doubt about that. That's well documented, Melody.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then the
communism, the whole Bolshevik Revolution, was again controlled by the classic techniques of control from above and control from below, this kind of pincer movement where you have funding from the Jewish bankers like Rothschild and Schiff, And then you have the actual revolutionaries on the ground, who are supported by these by the people at the top who actually make it happen. And then even if you look at the records of who was on the Communist Politburos, in the early 20s, et cetera, you find 80% of them are Jewish. Lenin's real name, I think, Trotsky's real name was Bronstein. Lenin's mother was a Jew. I mean, you go right down the list, and the people that carried out the Bolshevik Revolution are 85 to 90% Jewish. And
yeah.
There's lots and lots of documentation from various intelligence agencies at that time that this is the case.
Where do the Chinese come in on this?
The Chinese are the next target. They're the next target. That's why, all of our production was moved over there. But I wanted to comment on what you said, controlling from above and below. And that's kind of that pincer is what is happening to the middle class in this country. And the revolutionary forces from below, of course, those are all the illegal aliens, taking the blue-collar jobs and basically economically disempowering the people at the bottom, and then from the top, the Indians coming in, taking the knowledge jobs, from the top of the middle class, and, basically putting the American people in a squeeze play.
You guys, we're getting close to the point of the end of the program, and I'm just wondering, Vicki, if we were able to cover everything that you had in mind or had any closing comments, and you, Eric?
All I would say is that the conspiracy that our country is embroiled in is massive, and it's taken me about a decade to put all the pieces together, and it's all on my website, and I'm trying to organize now in all of the pieces of my research in a way that tells a coherent story. I'm not quite there yet, but anybody that wants to can go to my website, and it's www.channelingreality.com.
Eric?
Well, yeah, I'd like to say thank you, especially to Vicki. This is, I think, our third interview with her, and she is one of the people with a really, really global view of things, which is what we need. I've been involved trying to figure out what's going on with the 911 thing, and then later with the whole global warming thing. And you can take any one of these frauds, and I think you can look deeper and deeper and deeper into it until you find out kind of who is perpetrating the fraud and who benefits. But then, at some point you have to pull out of your own little that particular fraud and see it in the context of the larger program, the larger plan, which is what Vicki is trying to describe for us. So when we do an interview with somebody like Joan Vian or Vicki Davis, then I think we can really make quick progress in terms of understanding what's happening in the world. And so for that, I really thank Vicki for taking the time to join us, and I'll be hopefully have another chance in the future to talk and touch base as things go forth.
Anytime. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about it, because it is complex, it's deep, it's massive, and any help that I can give to anybody to shortcut the effort in figuring it out, I'm happy to do.
Well, Vicki, I want to thank you, because you definitely have a lot of time and effort involved in this project, and I'm sure it's going to be an ongoing one. So, and again, I want to thank you for coming on the program, and you too, Eric.
Okay. Well, thank you both, and goodbye for now.
Okay. Good night.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.